It all started with a very simple idea. Tell the stories of how successful middle market CEOs made it to the corner office. I'm Brand Handley, founder and managing director of Resource Options International, or ROI. We're the USA's premier executive search firm focused exclusively on empowering middle market companies to attract, hire, and retain A players while transforming top executives' careers and lives. ROI's Into the Corner office is dedicated to discovering how middle market CEOs advance their career, and we're making these remarkable and sometimes quite unbelievable stories available to you for the very first time. Listen and learn about the challenges they've overcome, the interesting people they've met along the way, and the lessons learned that steered these executives' unique journey into a middle market corner office of their own. I know you enjoy these CEO stories as much as I've enjoyed recording them. So thank you for listening today. And if you like what you've heard, rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm looking forward to you joining me on the next great middle market CEO adventure into the corner office. Hello again, this is Brand Handley. I'm founder and managing director of ROI Executive Search, and we do retained executive search across the middle market globally. Today's the next step in our journey into the corner office, and I'm here to welcome Gonzalo Zubieta. He's a CEO, founder, and a disruptive transformation expert with more than 15 years of experience in leadership and strategy consulting. He's the head of Emmett Partners, a consulting firm that helps Fortune 100 companies redefine their value proposition, strategic design, and value chain creation. Gonzalo Zubieta, welcome into the corner office.
Thank you so much, Brent. It's a pleasure to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
Good to have you here today. Where does the podcast find you today? I think you're down in Miami, Fort Lauderdale area, correct?
Correct. I am in Littletown. It's about 30-year-old town called Weston, and used to be called the Venice of Florida.
Ah.
Because it's surrounded with lakes, and nice. It's quite beautiful, but especially it's ideal for family. So if you want to raise kids, this is the place to do it.
I love it. Well, I'm sure it's not where you grew up, because we've talked before about your early origins, and let's kind of get started there. Tell me about your early years. Where did you grow up, and what was your early family life like?
Well, since I'll speak backwards, and I like to approach things in a disruptive way, and so one of the key things about my life was that since I was a little kid, I wanted to be in America. And for some reason, the first movie I watched, I said, this is the place I want to be. And that was something very particular about me, because I was always a dreamer, always dreaming since I was little. And I was born in Bolivia. Until I was about 18 years old, I left Bolivia, but I grew up there, and I was very ambitious. I always wanted to study abroad, so I started finding out ways how do I get out of this my limitations, because I knew that I was going to be very frustrated there. And my mindset was always about possibilities. There's a great book about, I don't know if you read The Art of Possibilities, but it's just a wonderful book about how you can think about your problems from possibilities. And even though I never read the book when I was a kid, but that's one thing that I always had that in mind, is how can I think about possibilities? What are options out there? And I had that dream, and I left Bolivia. I grew up without a father. Mm. He was killed when I was 1 year old.
Wow.
And that was an important trigger for faith. I think some people have their path to God through, life experiences, and they need a savior. And for me, my starting point was the absence of a father was the trigger for me to say, I'm sure there is a God. And then from being a God to being a father, that is my journey as a kid.
Was your mother a believer? Did she grow up in the church?
Well, we grew up Catholics, and we have in my family, one of my brothers is a pastor. I'm the youngest of three, and he became a pastor. We ran parallel lives. He left Bolivia, went to Argentina, and I went to United States. He went to a Bible seminary, and I just found my path to God in a different way. But we became believers around 14, 16 years old. And my mother, even though she still declares herself as Catholic, her doctrine is Christian. So if you ask her about saints and about transubstantiation and all that, she doesn't believe in that doctrine. So I always joke with her and say, "Ma'am, Mom, I think you're not a Catholic." But she definitely go.
What kind of work did she do to support you and your brothers and sisters?
So she worked in a bank. She was the treasurer, and she was very good with math. And which is interesting because from the side of my father, my grandfather, he was a very, very, very serious man, very intelligent. He was very, very bright. The way we play with him, he was not playful at all. But the way we play with him, we would just write down numbers, three-digit numbers, and make a column of about 5 to 8 numbers, 355, 271. And just make that line, and then he wouldn't add first column, second column, third column. He would just go down his finger down the line, and he would add the numbers in his head. And so I grew up with a mother that liked math and was good at math and worked as a treasurer in a bank, and then my grandfather, also math. And I always loved math, and so that's a bit of my background. I'll tell you more about my grandfather because that's an interesting story. But my mom worked there, and then she retired when I was still pretty young. And we had a mother that spent a lot of time working. So I grew up from Monday to Friday, I wouldn't see her very often. Mm. And that's also an important part of my journey of understanding how do you deal with the fact that you get home and there's nobody home. So I grew up with that fact of not a lot of people at home when I would go back home, because everybody, either my brothers, I'm the youngest. So my sister, she's the oldest. She's 4 years old, older than me. And she left when I was about 16 years old. She went to study to La Paz, and then my brother. So I was left home, and so I had this transition of going from a busy mother to people leaving the house. So I learned to be on my own, and so when I have to deal with people that struggle with loneliness, I have no problem being alone. And I think that this is one of the issues we're facing today, as you may know. I don't know if you had a podcast about loneliness in America, but I did a podcast for one CEO that she created this solution for helping people break away from loneliness. And so that's a very interesting part of also of my journey, that CEOs are very lonely. And CEOs have the Lone Ranger syndrome, and they cannot complain or talk freely to the board because they're under the pressure of the board, and they cannot share freely with their teams. So they end up being very lonely in their role. They get home and they cannot share the challenges with the husband or wife because they won't understand the language. And obviously they cannot talk about the issues with the kids. And so I think for me, that was a very interesting input in my life about really learning this, the meaning of what does it mean to be alone? I think the more you know yourself and the more you're at peace with yourself, the less problems you have being alone. And today we have, I don't know if you have teenagers, I have teenagers, but one of the issues I deal with, even my clients' children, is that the children they don't know how to deal with loneliness. They just turn on their phone and look at social media. So the root cause of that is not social media. Is I don't know how to handle loneliness. So what do I do with this void? So that's a long answer for what did my mom do and what effect that had in my life.
What were your motivations around coming to the U.S. and then how did you start that journey?
Well, I wasn't very good at speaking English, and so I decided I would teach myself English. So I would, there were no solutions on the internet, obviously, because there was no internet when I grew up. And I just sit down and start memorizing words, and the little English I got at school, I would just really dedicate my time because I had this vision that I didn't know how, really. I didn't know how to get out of Bolivia and go to America, but one of my dreams was to study at Harvard. And the first thing I started looking for options, and we had a student that came to live in our house from the United States. We had an exchange program, and he was an amazing blessing in my life. He came as a missionary, even though he was not a missionary, but he came to, you know, really to be in Bolivia and have a foreign experience. And that we had one guy from New York, Thomas, and then one guy from Dallas, Greg. I really like the way they thought, because American culture is visionary. They're sophisticated. They look for solutions. They really have their perspective in life. So I start becoming captivated by American culture. I love the movies. I always love to see how life was in America and the life of the pioneers. And so, short story, the parents of Greg came to visit him to Bolivia, and the father said, "Would you like to come to America?" And I say, "Yes." And so he helped me to come to America, kind of like the son did an exchange, that was not part of the program for me to go to live with them, but the father offered that, and that really changed my life. He offered this option to my brother and sister, and they said no. And then when he came to me, I said yes. I mean, by all means. So when I got that possibility, I didn't have a scholarship yet, so I had to work very hard to pass the TOEFL. So I took 3-month intensive English program, and the director of the program for people that wanted to learn English, she said that it would take me about close to 6 to 8 months to learn English to the level of TOEFL required to go to college. So I needed 550, and my score was like 480. And she said, it takes about 6 months for 100 points. And I had to do it in 3 months. And so my journey was always breaking these limitations in my life, and really working hard and doing the impossible for things. And so I did it. It was amazing. I got my score. I passed, and then I got a start with a Lewis scholarship at Austin College. I went to Austin College, and then I wanted to know, you know, what to study. And clearly today is funny, because today I know why I studied economics. I don't practice economics, but the way they train you as an economist is that you have to think systemically. So the way economists understand the world is through systems. So they look at systemically, you know, macroeconomic system, the microeconomic system, and that's the way economists think. And so that's, without knowing, I chose economics, and I loved economics. And then I studied business. So I had the option to do a dual degree. So I did business administration and economics. I always had it in me, the entrepreneur, and I wanted to create things, and I wanted to invent things. So that was my, just, I told you the story in 5 minutes. It's a bit more complex than that. But in essence, I began to see my dream coming true. And I obviously I pray, and for me, prayer is powerful. Usually, probably you have this experience where you are with businessmen that not necessarily pray, and sometimes we have this notion that prayer is complex or mechanic, but it's actually like a conversation. It's like you and me talking. It's really to be able to communicate not what is in your mind, but what's in your heart and what you're willing to do. And so I always pray about that dream, and the dream became true. I mean, I had, in my life is full of dreams. When I tell my kids about my life, I always tell them is dream. Don't be afraid of dreaming. Just anything you want in life, you can do it.
What was that first job you took out of college?
So I graduated from Texas, and I wanted to be in an international context. So I wanted to go to Washington, D.C. And for some reason, that was my destination. And so I started working at the first job I got to Washington, D.C. I lived in Northern Virginia in Potomac Falls. And I started living there. And first I had a job of, during college, I did all kinds of jobs to pay for my expenses because the scholarship didn't cover all my expenses. So I did all kinds of jobs trying to earn a living. And then I started working for a little bit. I work at a conference center, which is interesting because that's what I do for a living now. Right, I give conferences everywhere, and so I started working at a conference center, and just doing the administrative part. And I was really frustrated because I was thinking, you know, what am I doing here? And so I started always looking for a job, and I found this little ad. After a few months working there, I found this little ad in the newspaper that said, "Export Software International is looking for an analyst." And so I send my resume, and the person that called me for an interview was a Christian, which was really, really amazing. And we had an amazing interview, and I was like employee number 8 when I left. So we grew up from 8 people to 500 people. We opened 12 countries. And so I lived the American dream very quickly, and that was a very important, really an amazing story how I started working there. And I had no experience as a software developer, but I was very good at being a business analyst. So I quickly went up the ladder on the company. I became a director. I worked with them 8 years. So that was really my real first job working for this startup that was not corporate America per se, but it became corporate America because we grew up and expanded. And so I quickly start applying the things I learned in college. It's not knowledge, right? At the end, it's mindset. I always tell my kids that it's not how much you know, it's how you think that you need to worry about this. Do you love to study? Do you open your mind to possibilities? To how do you understand the way your teacher learns and thinks? And so all that I learned in college, I start applying it just to really, in a very practical way, is how do we make this business grow? How do we deal with clients? And it's a beautiful story because some of our first clients were Microsoft was one of our first clients. So we developed software for Microsoft to export and import their software. Then we had Nike. We developed for Nike the automation for letter of credit. I don't know if you're familiar with what is a letter of credit, but it's the document for purchasing exports or imports. So you have a letter of credit, and Nike would use our system to manage about $1 billion of transactions. So So we quickly became very relevant in the market. And so that was my almost first job. That was my second job, if you want to call it, but first job in corporate America.
Did you have some mentors that kind of led you along the way?
Yes. One habit that I always had was, no matter where I lived, because I lived in many countries. When I was in college, I went to France. I lived there for a semester in Lyon. And then when I was in Washington, D.C., I went to study a program. I did a global trade program. I got this scholarship to go to Oxford. So I did a certification on global trade. And one of the things I learned in the path of going to these different places was always to look for meaningful connections. And some of the connections became mentors, but I think the emphasis I gave to spending time, like I had a friend at the conference center, I had a friend from Poland. He was about 8 years older than me, and we always had lunch. Even though I quit my job, I remained in contact with him, and I continued to visit with him. And he was not a mentor per se, but he was a great person where I had meaningful connections, meaningful relationship where I can ask the difficult questions. And so I had, every time I moved, like I moved from Washington, D.C. to Cambridge, Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico to Chile and back, all that journey, that's been one of my habits. If you want to understand a person, ask them, what habits do they have? And for me, that was one habit, is you have to have mentors. And today, that's what I do for one of the key things I do for my clients, is I work with them, and I'm a mentor to many CEOs over the years. And in particular, my first mentor, I would say, was this guy at the conference center. He was an old man, very old man, very the nicest man you can imagine. And we always had conversations, and he always told me stories about life and how he looked at life. So he was one of my first, he managed a little store at the conference center. And he was the first person that started telling me stories about how to understand life. And then came Albert Cross and the guy from Poland, and then became the person that hired me into the startup. He also is a mentor and continues to be in touch with me. I continue to be in touch with him. And so he was a very important person. So I would say I have many mentors. And until today, I still have very good mentors in my life. I am very conscious that that's important.
What led to the founding of Emmett Partners? Tell us a little bit about the origin stories.
Great question. So there is an inflection point in my life. I was very determined in everything I did in my life. I was very, not obsessed, but very focused. Whatever I put in my mind to do, you know, if I had to learn English or do sports, I did sports. And so at Vastera, the export software company, we changed the name to Vastera. And vast and then Terra. And we brought the two words together. But when we were there, I had stock options. So I was among the oldest stock owners. And one of the things I did was work very, very hard. I worked 70, 80 hours a week. I would work Saturdays. I remember that I would come back from church and I worked from 3 to 6 some Sundays. And sometimes I would stay until 1 in the morning working. I remember some of the vice presidents would be sitting around the hallways falling asleep because we were waiting for the software release to come out. And it was a very exciting time, really thrilling, very young, a lot of energy. And so about we decided to go public, do an IPO in NASDAQ. And so we went public 2001. But about 2 months before we went public in NASDAQ, I had a surmenage. I had a nervous breakdown. And I called my wife and I said, I can't move. I said, there's something happening to me. My body does not respond. So she came to my office. she took me to the emergency room, to a hospital in Washington, D.C. And after a couple of hours of tests and blood work and all kind of tests and waiting in the emergency room, the doctor came and he said, I have good news. You have nothing physical. Your problem is emotional. And that for me was very, it didn't make me angry, but it really upset me because I thought I had life under control. I really thought that I can control everything. I wasn't very emotional. I was very mental when problems came. So if I had a conflict with somebody and the person comes to me and says, you did this and you did that, and I would say, okay, tell me what I did wrong, and I'll say, I'm sorry. And for me, it was mechanical. And I was married. I've been married with the same wife, but I was married the second year when I had the surmenage, been married, recently married. And the way I handled my dynamic with my wife was I, you know, if I did something wrong, I'm sorry. And that was it. You know, but I couldn't go below my neck. I always say leadership is below the neck, authority is above the neck. and so I had no understanding of what happens in my heart, what happens in my gut. And at the hospital, I had three questions that changed my life. Obviously, I didn't understand the questions because this is all at the subconscious level. But I had these three main questions. The first one was, what moves me? And one of the things I began to realize, it took me 5 years to understand this question, was that my engine, if you would, was outside of me, was my mission, was what do I need to do? What do I need to accomplish? What things do I need to have? And what achievements and titles I want to have? So really my engine was outside. And obviously back then, the word purpose was not very used. Today, everybody talks about purpose. But I'm telling you, in 2001, nobody talked about purpose. It was not even a word in the business language. And but I knew there was something missing. And I found that the word I was missing was purpose. The second question at the hospital was, who am I? And I knew what titles I had. I knew I was a husband. I didn't have kids yet. I was a brother. I was a son. I was, you know, I went up the corporate ladder. I have titles, but I didn't know who I was. And that was the second painful question, identity. And so today I have extrapolated that learning from identity to help my companies as well, because the most competitive companies I work with, they have identity. And I didn't have an identity, and that's been an amazing journey for my life, what I learned through that question. And the third question was destination. I didn't have a destiny. I didn't have a sense of direction. I didn't know where I was going. And today I understand that it has to do with your legacy and how you want to transcend. And so those were the three questions. I left the hospital. I recovered quickly because it was nothing physical. I was not depressed. I don't recall being depressed in my life. Obviously, you have moments that you're down, but I don't recall moments of depression. But for me, it took me from 2001 to 2004. I decided to sell my stocks, my stock options. Unfortunately, we went public after the dot-com bubble. We were not a dot-com company. And this is one of the lessons I learned when I'm in boards. I always talk about this story because the company failed to ambition. We were going to go public with Goldman Sachs, and they said, let's go public in March. And then when the dot-com exploded, they said, well, let's go September 2001. If you didn't recall anything about the stock market, that's when the stock market collapsed. And we, at the end, we went public with Alex Brown Deutsche Bank. And this is when I realized that how people change under ambition and how things, all the things that transpire in the company were really painful to see. And, you know, that that created a really bad situation for the company because our valuation went down so much. And so when I was able to sell my stock options, I didn't sell. I couldn't do that big dream I had about the stock options. And that trigger, I said to my wife, okay, I'm going to sell my stock options. I'm going to take a sabbatical and I want to go back to school. And so I, while I was at this startup, I did a master's degree in Washington, D.C. in international commerce, but I wanted to do one in leadership and strategy. And so I told my wife, I'm only going to study for Harvard. If they don't accept me, I'll find out a second plan. So I started to take the study very hard for 3 months, 8 p.m. until 1, 2 in the morning. I would get home, had dinner, take a nap, and then study until 2, 3 in the morning. I did this for 3 months, and I did it. I studied, I took the test, and short story, I sent my application, and I got accepted. And that began the path of transformation, because when I got accepted and we moved, we were in Washington, D.C., so we moved to Cambridge. And it was an amazing year and a half of really finding the answer to these three questions. So I took all the leadership courses I could take. I became a student assistant to a couple of my leadership professors. I did networking with so many amazing people in my program. There were like 60 countries represented. It was really incredible. And so all that led me to this journey of how can I serve leaders like myself that are lost with these three questions. So that was the kind of like the seed of Emmett Partners, of really how do I serve servants? Because I really believe that CEOs should be servants. And I always tell CEOs, I say, listen, you are there to bless so many people. So many families depend on how you perform. It's not about the bottom line. It's about the impact you have in so many families, giving them jobs. So I graduated from Harvard, and I met this woman that she offered me a job in Puerto Rico. So I moved to Puerto Rico for a year. I don't know if you've been to Puerto Rico, but it was a bit too relaxing for me. I wanted a bit more fast pace. I was more used to more fast pace. And I began to get frustrated in Puerto Rico. So I started looking for options. I helped them to develop a business and an NGO. And we started doing advice and consulting. So that was a bit of my beginning of how do you start a business again, you know, helping the owner and the wife starting an NGO. And I got involved into that. And when I did my program at Harvard, I knew that one of the professors he had a consulting firm, and I'll never forget when I graduated, he said, "Keep in touch. I would like for you one day to get involved with my consulting firm." Short story, I got an invitation to go to a conference in Chile, and met a few people, and they offered me to stay. They offered me partnership. Short story, we moved to Chile, and we had a hard time having, we were trying to have kids. And my wife had a lot of issues getting pregnant. We lost like 6 pregnancies. It was not an easy journey. And so we moved to Chile, and my 3 boys were born there. And that's where I begin to this journey of, okay, I want to have my own company. I don't want to have a partner. I want to have my own company. I want to start with Emmett Partners. And I start doing consulting to big multinational corporations. And back then it was the boom of the mining sector in Chile. And I started doing the consulting to them and did really well. They really loved my approach. And I had a very creative approach to do strategic planning and to do team integration. And then I started working with family businesses. So that started developing my business. And I helped some of the most important family businesses in Europe, in LATAM, and United States, very, you know, very powerful family businesses. And I realized that my contribution to their business was important, but it was equally or more important my contribution to the dynamic of the team and to the dynamic of the family business. Awesome. And so I begin to realize that, wow, there is there's some value here, that the way I'm looking at their challenges and the way I'm articulating their conflict and the way I'm helping them to solve their conflicts is powerful. So that is how Emmet Partners was born. I don't know if you know what it means, Emmet. So Emmet is a Hebrew word, and Emmet is three letters. If you look at Emmet in Hebrew, there are three letters. The first letter of the word Emmet is the first letter of the alphabet. And the last letter of the word Emmet is the last letter of the alphabet. And the middle letter of the alphabet, if you put all the letters in a line and you choose the one in the middle, exactly the one in the middle is the word, the third letter in the middle. So the beginning, the end, and the center. And that's why the word Emmet in Hebrew culture is powerful.
Alpha when, Omega.
When Jesus said, I am the truth, he said, I am Emmet.
Gonzalo, we're just about out of time, but I did have one last question we always ask our CEO guests, and that's, you know, what kind of career and life advice would you give to someone who has their eyes on, you know, being an entrepreneur like yourself someday?
Yes, well, I'm an advisor at Endeavor, and I'm a mentor with Endeavor, and most of, you know, all of them are in the same place I was when I was 25 years old, which is start a new business. And the way I help them is really to, for me, when I do the kickoff session at Endeavor, the first thing I do is to really pay attention to the way they understand themselves and to split the difference between what is my role versus who am I. And this distinction between role versus being is a very important, because if you build an organization thinking that your identity is your role, you're going to be very frustrated and you're not going to be able to handle failure. Because if you think you are the CEO, then you're going to hate to lose. You're going to hate to fail because it's your identity is based on your role. But when you know who you are, you're better prepared for failure. And the reality is that, you know, 90% of businesses fail. So the first question is, are you prepared to do that? And that has to do with your foundation. Your foundation has to be your identity. The second advice I give is, I have a tool that I use to map the challenges of leaders. It's called FlowIQ. And this tool measures how you're wired based on neuroscience. So if you're wired for power or influence, if you are inclined to authority or leadership, and then it measures your oscillation, which is head, heart, and guts. So it gives you a percentage of how much you are. If you're, you know, 40% heart and 30% guts, or vice versa, and there are multiple combinations of that. And then the last one is your identity based on your role or your being? And so for me, the second advice is, you need to understand if you're wired for exercising authority or exercising leadership. And this is very important, because if you're wired for power, you're going to have a very hard time leading your organization through growth. Because during growth, you don't need authority. You need leadership. You need to empower people. And so knowing your brain wiring, that's one of the key things. That's a requirement. Everybody that works with me, I work with teams, they take the test. And so that clearly gives you a map of what is going to be their challenge. So if, let's say, Brandt is leadership, his struggles are not going to come from leadership, are going to come from when he failed to exercise authority. And if Brandt is wired for authority, his struggles are going to come when he had to exercise leadership and he didn't do it. And the third, so that's that for me, that's the second element. The third element is to really understand that company's performance is based on three dimensions, right? If you do three circles, one is people, the other circle is processes, and the other circle is systems. And so if you want to be a successful business, you need to remember these three dimensions of how are you doing with the type of people you have? Do you have the right DNA? Do the people that you're hiring have the DNA? And I'm sure you have to deal with this in your practice when you do recruitment. And I don't do recruitment per se, but I do talent calibration, which is I really help figure out people, how they're wired to get the position they're managing. And to understand that you need to focus on these three dimensions, is people, processes, and systems. And so your high-performing team will depend on these three, of managing these three circles. And obviously, I always encourage them to remain connected. I work with YPO. You probably know about YPO. And so one of the exciting things I get to do is do retreats with YPOs. And I share with them these lessons I learned over the years. And we go into some place for 2 days. And I'm with 7, 8 CEOs. And we talk about this, all the challenges that go with leading your organization and being a CEO.
Fantastic. Well, Gonzalo, thank you so much for sharing your journey. Gonzalo Zubieta is the CEO and founder of Emmett Partners.
Thank you so much, Brent. I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure sharing with you a bit of my journey.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Into the Corner Office with Brant Hanley. We hope you enjoyed hearing our guest CEO story as much as we did. If you want to hear more CEOs reveal their journey into the corner office, please subscribe via iTunes and tell your friends and colleagues. For more information about Brant, Resource Options International, and the Mighty Middle Market, visit www.goforroi.com. We look forward to having you join us for our next episode.